All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
And good afternoon, right here. This is Bob Gould coming to you for Veterans Radio, right here in the Garden Spot of Michigan, the Midwest, Ann Arbor, Michigan, at our station, at our flagship station right here, WAAM 1600. What is WAAM? Somebody asked me that the other day. AA stands for Ann Arbor. Get it? WAAM. But anyway, so, and my partner Dale, he's out doing Santa's work today. Probably getting the tree and all that good business. And we're going to be doing lots of things. Today, folks, we're going to change our format. I've wanted to do, have a program where I have a panel and we talk about military leaders, military stories, and we bring out the anecdotal stuff, the stuff that, see, these three guests that I have, they spent decades researching this. I'm not sure why, how, but they do. They spent a lot of time and energy, and today they're going to share, because I have a list of military leaders from World War II, from Korea, and we're going to touch them all. We're going to talk about the grit factor. Grit. I had to come up with something to measure these. On television, they had something called the badass factor. Well, we're going to have the grit factor, and we'll get to that in just a minute. And our three guests, but before we do that, this being the holidays, it's still time to do some shopping. And Kevin? Derek? Give it a shot. Life Chest. Yes, sir. Life Chest. Folks, if you're looking for something special to give that veteran, or actually you could use it for a lot of different circumstances and occasions, the Life Chest, thelifechest.com, thelifechest.com. And I just can't begin to tell you about all the different models and designs. I'm not even going to attempt to do that, but what I'm going to say is that if you want to leave a legacy and you want to have your veteran in your life, or you are the veteran and you want to have somewhere to keep all those documents and maybe a flag or boots or a special pack of cigarettes. Well, you know, they're in cardboard boxes. They're at the bottom of the closet and they're covered with dirty clothes. I mean, you know, raise your hand, all those out there that can find their DD-214. Just what I thought, about 10%, right? You know where it is? Well, you could if you had it in one place, and that's what the Life Chest provides. An array and different styles of Life Chests that are for your personal, it's your personal sort of Foot Locker. Now, they're not the size of Foot Lockers. They're actually smaller. In fact, right now, Life Chest folks told us that as a special for Veterans Radio, you don't need a code, 50%. Complimentary Christmas discount. Let me tell you that again. 50% complimentary Christmas discount. So you go to lifechest.com, and you're going to want to take a look at all the different models that are out there. Remember, it's 50% for the holidays all the way through to January 1. So go on. Go online, thelifechest.com, check all the models out, give them a call, give them an email, because you want to preserve, protect, and secure your memorabilia, especially from, you know, guys that have been in the service. They got all this stuff, and it's all scattered. And keeping track of your personal thing, that DD-214, something happens to you and your spouse or whomever you're, your survivors of, whoa, we got to find the DD-214. What's going on? And that way it's in one location. So that's thelifechest.com, 50% complimentary. And what else? I think I got everything else. Derek, let's go to our first bump. You ready? Take it. Stretch it. Oh, he says stretch. Okay. This is the I'll Be Home for Christmas. Happened to be the 1943 number one song. Yes, I'll be home for Christmas. And Derek, are we cool with that? Good. Fire it away.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can plan on me. Please have snow and mistletoe and presents on the tree.
I'll be home for Christmas. And who sang that one, Heidi? Do you have that on the... That's a great song, huh?
Glenn Campbell.
Oh, Glenn Campbell. I made a promise never to play any more Glenn Campbells. I didn't see the... But he's a guy. Now, anyway, we won't get into that, folks. I think Glenn's still around, but that's cool. I'll be home for Christmas, number one song in 1943. It was actually number one song, too, when I was in the Army, and all of us. But anyway, back to grit. Grit. Aha. Okay, this is going to be a slam dunk format, folks. I'm going to have three historians on the line at once. Are we all hooked up, Derek, with Skype? And oh, boy, I've got the thumbs up. I can't believe we're really doing this. Whoa, doggy. Okay, and I want to get the five characteristics. Well, what is grit from the Webster Dictionary? Grit is the context of behavior, firmness of character, indomitable spirit, perseverance, and passion for long-term goals. Oh, part of the big picture. And when I had a chance to talk with Kevin Hemel, one of our historians today, and we were talking about all of these folks, we wanted to come up with what was some of the commonality that they all possessed. And one thing that Kevin said is that they would rather die than fail. Yes. So we're going to get right to that. And on the line with me right now is, I want to get all these, is Bill Latham. Bill Latham is a military historian. He's a retired Army officer and a veteran of Desert Storm. He has published many works on a variety of military topics, Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea, and he currently teaches at the logistics, at the Army Logistics University at Fort Lee, Virginia. He lives in Colonial Heights, Virginia, but he works in procurement. Every time, Bill, welcome to Veterans Radio. I got to say something. Bill?
Good afternoon, Bob. How you doing?
I love it, and I love every time I say that you're in charge of procurement. We used to have one of the guys, you know, well, we won't talk about that, when we had a three-day pass, and it was his job to make sure we had enough alcohol and all that. But that's not what you do. You do all kinds of things for the Army Logistics, but not only that, you've written these books, and gosh, Bill, welcome to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back with you in a second. Don't go away. I'm going to introduce the other two.
You bet.
Good. Got it. Okay. Kevin Hemel, my buddy. Kevin and I are now Skyping. Yes, we are Skype, and I'm going to get a camera, and then, yeah, we got the headphones. It's going to be really cool. Kevin is a former historian for the U.S. Army's Combat Studies Institute. He's written military history narratives on the war in Afghanistan, and he's author of, by the way, if you're still looking for something to get stocking stuffer for that veteran, or anybody for that matter, Patton's Photographs and Patton, Legendary World War II Commanders. We'll tell you all about that when we get... Kevin, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Can you hear me okay, Bob?
Ah, yeah. Give him a little more audio. Give him a little more, yeah. Okay. Yes, we can. Welcome. And we did it.
You're glad to be here, huh?
Yeah, and it's actually better than the regular phone line. Okay.
My microphone's not working.
Oh, no, your microphone's working just fine, right? How are we doing? Okay, Derek, I'm getting thumbs up from everybody. Good. And I got to keep the show. Hold on, and let me get John McManus. Our third guest is author John McManus. He's professor of military history at Missouri University of Science and Technology. John McManus, he's written numerous books on World War II and also serves as a member of the editorial board at World War II magazine. Is this cool or what? He's researched his book, Alamo and the Ardennes, September Hope, etc. We'll talk all about those in just a minute. John McManus, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Bob, how are you? Thank you.
I'm loving it. I know you're busy, and thank you, all three of you, for taking time out. And by the way, folks, this is live. That's right. They're taking time out from their families to be with us. Okay. Whew. Well, this is going to be a free forum. The only thing I ask you, gentlemen, and you can jump in at any time if you want to comment on any of our historical figures, just I ask that you identify yourself. Okay, you know, this is John or whatever, something like that. Cool. So, grit. The whole thing about grit, I'm looking at some of the characteristics that I wrote down: resilience, fortitude, fidelity, courage, passion, command, respect, religion, tenacity. Yes. Matthew Ridgway. Colonel Latham, tell us about him and the grit factor.
So you want me to talk about Ridgway, Bob?
Yes.
You didn't even make my top three.
No, but I'm letting everybody's going to comment on each one. So you get the first if you want to do just a short comment on Ridgway.
Happy to. Ridgway is one of the outstanding commanders of World War II. He is arguably the preeminent airborne leader of World War II. But just as noteworthy is that Ridgway is arguably responsible for turning around the UN effort in Korea when he takes command in December of 1950, replacing General Walton Walker, who died. Ridgway flies in, assumes command, and immediately 8th Army, which he is appointed as commander of, sees a turning point. And finally, Ridgway ends his career in typical gritty fashion, you might say, by retiring rather than remain chief of staff of the Army when President Eisenhower proposes to reduce the size of the Army below the level that Ridgway thinks is appropriate.
And when did all this happen?
Ridgway comes back from Korea and becomes the chief of staff of the Army. He is the top soldier in the Army at that point. Eisenhower is the newly elected president, and Eisenhower wants to reduce military spending. And one way to do that in the 1950s was to spend more on nuclear weapons and airplanes and less on manpower. And the biggest bill payer for manpower was the United States Army. So Eisenhower wants to shrink the Army. Ridgway protests vehemently and then leaves his job rather than stay on as a form of protest.
John McManus, tell us about Ridgway.
Yeah, Ridgway was born to be a soldier. It was said that he was born to the sound of a reveille cannon because he was the son of an officer. And, of course, as Bill had mentioned, he's one of the pioneers in the airborne effort in World War II, certainly, and he ends up as commander of the 82nd Airborne Division, later commander of the 18th Airborne Corps, which was really, the latter is really the number one airborne command you could have in World War II. And Ridgway is an interesting combination of battlefield courage,
Give us an example of battlefield courage for Ridgway.
Well, battlefield courage, in his case, this was a guy who was not really a classically trained paratrooper. He doesn't really come up through the airborne ranks in terms of training the way, say, his second-in-command, Jim Gavin, did. So he really was a guy who was recognized as being an exceptional leader who they happened to put into the airborne rather than launching his career through the airborne. And he didn't have a whole lot of experience parachuting into battle, and yet he leads the 82nd Airborne Division into the night jump in Normandy and performs very, very well, so well in Normandy that, as I mentioned, he gets promoted to Corps Command. So Ridgway later wrote in his memoirs that, you know, as he laid his head to rest, before going to bed, as he went to bed before he was jumping into Normandy, he had a great amount of fear about what was to come and jumping out of.
That's one thing I want everybody to comment on, or not all at once, of course, but the fear factor. What? Tell us about that. I mean, and it's okay to be afraid. And how do you feel he worked that into his command?
Me? John?
The fear factor. Bravery.
Yeah. And, you know, in his case, what I found interesting is that he admitted the fear factor. And not all generals at his level do that. In fact, I'd say the majority don't. And in his case, he attempted to put it out of his mind by focusing completely on his job and his responsibility of leading this, division of paratroopers and glidermen into combat. That had to come first. And obviously, that takes character for any officer, but I also felt it was courageous for him to even admit that in print for such a distinguished general, so well known, and as Bill had chronicled very well, you know, his career leading troops in Korea and, of course, later as chief of staff of the Army.
John, there actually is a word name for fear of failure. It's called ATYCHI, atychophobia. ATYCHI phobia. Atychophobia. It's the medical folks call it. They say it can be debilitating, but I think it's kind of a motivating factor for the folks that we're going to be talking about today. Kevin, you want to comment on that?
Sure, Bob. Let me just mention real quick, I can't hear my colleagues, so tell me if I'm repeating anything. But with Ridgway, you know, I think he really set the tone early on in Sicily. He did not parachute in. He landed on the beach and basically just walked inland with a few staffers into enemy territory looking for paratroopers that had jumped in the night before. So I think he really kind of sets the tone early in World War II. Then, you know, goes on to great success in Normandy. And in the Bulge, you know, the Bulge and Korea, I would say, really illustrate the kind of leader he is because, you know, that's where tenacity and grit come from. Because when things are going your way and you have the momentum, a lot of people are great commanders. It's when the odds are against you and all seems lost and yet you stand up and face the enemy almost fearlessly. And that's what he does in the Bulge when things are looking so grim. He becomes a corps commander. He has some ideas that are actually wrong about fighting a completely surrounded defensive battle. And his, you know, commanders below him say, sir, these are armored units we have. They're not airborne. They cannot be resupplied by the air. And
that's
once
right.
He understood that, he turned his thinking around. Then you get to Korea, and you have the entire Chinese army pushing down the Korean Peninsula. You've got MacArthur throwing his arms up in the air, basically saying this is a loss. And Ridgway stands in there. He stops the retreat and eventually gets the 8th Army pushing north again. And that really is, you really can't point to any other factor but Master Ridgway in that Korean War exercise. He really is. It's the force of one personality turning things around on a battlefield.
And folks, when you're talking airborne, now, just as Bill Latham said earlier, he didn't have the airborne experience, and that is airborne always parachutes behind the lines. We're always surrounded. I was with the 101st, by the way, and that's what you're taught. You got to fight your way out, and that was something that Ridgway had to learn. And so that tenacity was there, the courage was there, and the resilience, fortitude, etc. And we can get back to Matthew Ridgway in just a second, but I'd like you guys very quickly to give him a grit factor 1 to 10. Bill?
Oh, I'd give him a 9 easy.
Already. Okay. And John?
I would give him an 8.
And Kevin?
I'll give him a 10 with a smiley face next to it, gold star.
Okay, well, let's get right to the next airborne that was mentioned in you the gentleman giving me emails here, and that was James Gavin, who I believe was the 82nd Airborne. I think he was the oldest paratrooper, or the oldest general, I should say, at Normandy. And John, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, actually, it's the opposite, Bobby. He was the youngest. He was all of 37 years old when he got command of the 82nd Airborne Division. So he was known as Slim Jim to his troops, and he was such a combat soldier in how he led his division that he was often called the highest-ranking rifleman in the Army. He was famous for carrying around an M1 Garand rifle, and he was a guy who I really believe embodied grit, not just in Normandy, but from Sicily onward, really, through the end of the war, because of his willingness to constantly risk his own life, perhaps even when it didn't, you know, make the most command sense to do so. This was a guy who, as I think Kevin really articulately put it, would rather die than fail and live that, and almost died it, many, many times throughout World War II. I mean, when you look at accounts from soldiers of the 82nd Airborne Division, they're replete with examples of encountering James Gavin when things were pretty bad, you know, in terms of danger. Just hundreds of accounts that you'll find from people. So he tended to circulate. You tended to know him. He was the kind of leader who liked to inspire you by being there with you. And I think in some ways, the Battle of the Bulge is a fine moment for him, too, because he deals with a lot of the adversity Kevin had mentioned earlier in relation to General Ridgway, and he's really, you know, Ridgway's eyes and ears for what's actually happening.
Was he a religious man?
No, he really wasn't a religious man at all. He certainly believed in some level of spirituality, but actually I would describe him more as a ladies' man. He was a guy who certainly did enjoy women. He was going through a fairly nasty divorce at the time of World War II, and knew that he and his wife had very little in common, but he later remarries and then was no longer a ladies' man the rest of his life. So he was a guy who committed to you, whether you were someone who was under his command or whether you were his wife later in life or whatever. He was a person who had a very strong ethical base for everything he did. And I think perhaps that's part of where his grittiness came from.
Well, fidelity is on one of my... And by the way, folks, we're not here to... This is not going to be any expose or anything. These gentlemen all had feet of clay. They were huge, huge figures. And this is what we're getting at. You know, how did they function? How did they survive? Let's go back to Ridgway, and I want to ask very quickly... John, did he have a friend, or was he with the wife home? You know, Eisenhower had somebody, Patton had somebody, now Gavin. How about Ridgway?
No, Ridgway was more of a straight arrow in that regard. Certainly had that reputation in the Army. And he was completely dedicated to his family, but I think really more so he was dedicated to the Army. The Army was his life.
Sounds like me. But anyway, we got 3 minutes. So, okay, do we want to give a quick comment or a quick, let's start with Kevin. Give him a 1 to 10.
Oh, I'll give him a 10 with airborne wings on top.
I love that, airborne wings. You know, we're going to have some folks on the program, the Michigan Military Museum and Space Museum in Frankenmuth, Michigan. They have original wings. Yes, they were not made. They were made out of pure silver. They're beautiful. And just to see the different designs, wow, it's really cool. So I've seen the actual wings. 10. Okay, Bill?
Bob, I'd give Gavin a 9 as well, and I just want to point out that Gavin is one of the few famous generals from World War II who began his career as an enlisted man.
And how did he get, OCS, right?
Well, no, he served about a year on active duty as a gunner and then took the entrance exam for West Point and entered the military academy.
Oh, I love it. Okay. And John, give us... Your 1 to 10.
Well, I'd give Gavin a 10. And if we're talking about grit and tenacity, you know, Bill had mentioned that he started in the Coast Artillery. Well, he had run away from home to join the Army as an underage soldier. And it took tremendous perseverance to pass that exam because he wasn't even out of high school. He didn't have a high school diploma. And he got through West Point on a wing and a prayer to some extent.
So he had everything. He had the resilience and he had the fortitude. Good. Well, we've gotten 2. We got a few more to go. We got about a minute before. Can you believe we're halfway through? Gentlemen, What do you think would be another common denominator? And just jump right in. Just let us know who it is. Jump right in. What's another common denominator that you can think about that these men had? Anybody want to jump on that?
I'll take it. I think experience and education. They really adhered to their vocation. They really dedicated themselves and their lives to it, so that by the time they reached the battlefield, they were kind of seeing beyond the battlefield. You know, when you run a long race, they always tell you to not look at the finish line, but look beyond the finish line. And I think that's what these guys did during the course of a war. They were always looking onto the next battlefield and where this battle was going to lead.
Couldn't have said it any better. We got 30 seconds. We're going to a break. And in fact, this came up. That was wonderful. That was really great. That's exactly what we're talking about here when I talk about the grit factor. And if you do go online and Google grit, wow, there's about 10,000 sites that you can go to. We'll be right back. Veterans Radio, don't go away. Tops glisten. Oh, there was a lot of that going on during the Battle of the Buzz, that's for sure. But let's get right back to how did this all start? World War II caught us with our knickers down. We had no army to speak of. We got blasted. Although we've been watching what was happening over in Europe and how the Germans were strangling England, and we did the Lend-Lease Act. But when it hit the fan, there was one person they went to, and he put together a civilian army, George Marshall. Bill, tell us about that.
Well, I think Marshall is my vote for the grittiest general of the war. For one thing, he serves as chief of staff from 1939 to the end of the war, and he does so in an often contentious relationship with his boss, President Roosevelt. And in fact, arguably, he becomes chief of staff because he had the nerve to disagree with Roosevelt's plan to build 10,000 planes and provide them to the British.
Why did he do that? Why did he disagree?
Well, he was summoned to a meeting with other senior leaders and Roosevelt, and Roosevelt floated a fairly ill-thought-out concept of building thousands of airplanes and transferring them to the British without any training or other provisions put in place, logistical support. And Roosevelt went around the room, and everybody agreed with the president, of course, that it was a great idea, except General Marshall, who was offended that Roosevelt would address him as George, which he did at their first meeting.
Wow.
But nevertheless, Marshall had the guts to disagree with Roosevelt, and this is sort of a replay of one of Marshall's earlier characteristic moments when, as a chief of staff with the 1st Division in World War I, he had the nerve to disagree with General Black Jack Pershing. He later became one of Black Jack Pershing's most valued aides or staff officers. And so in both cases, Marshall's guts and his willingness to disagree publicly with his boss earns him the respect of the senior leaders. And in fact, as a young officer, Marshall twice is evaluated by commanders who give him the highest marks and say they would just as soon serve under him as have him serve under them. That's how impressive an individual Marshall is.
Well, it certainly impressed me, everything that I've read about him, to take nothing and build a civilian army. He had to do it. and he had to do a million men, millions, and he had to put that together. That took, what, command? Well, one thing I do want to ask you, Bill, the Private Ryan thing, did that really happen? Come on.
I doubt it.
Okay.
It's plausible, but
I
doubt it.
It's a great story.
But Marshall is probably, I think, most characteristic for his utter, absolute professionalism. He's a great talent scout. Most of the Army's senior leaders, certainly in Europe anyway, are handpicked by Marshall, Dwight Eisenhower, George Patton, Omar Bradley, Jacob Devers. He didn't get them all right. He also picked Friedendahl, who is relieved after the Battle of Kasserine Pass. But his batting average is very good. And Marshall, as you said in the intro, Marshall is the architect of this 8-million-man army that the United States is able to train, recruit and train and equip and feed and ship over to combat zones around the world, and he's able to do that quickly and fairly effectively at a time when our allies are desperate for American assistance, and what they need is troops in the field. So Marshall is really arguably the architect of American victory in World War II.
Oh, I've got to say that, too. I mean, everything, imagine, folks, nothing. Coming from and to organize a draft, to organize getting these men trained, getting them on troop ships, and you got a war on both fronts as Hitler declares war 3 days after Pearl Harbor, and Marshall is okay. Let's get down to it. He really, really, really did roll up his sleeves. Kevin, tell us a little bit about George Marshall.
Sure. You know, to give you an idea of his importance to the nation, he realized that if he walked out of the White House or the Defense Department smiling, everybody would think we're winning the war. And if he walked out frowning, people would think we're losing the war. So he had to keep a perfect poker face for practically 5 years to not give away what was going on the battlefront. You know, everyone in the Army and everybody in the military understood and appreciated and respected Marshall. But I think it's the people that came new into his circle that were so stunned by him. And a perfect example for me is he called in Frank Capra and said, listen, we're going to war now. I need you to make a series of films explaining to the GI and the civilian why we're going to war.
Yes.
And Capra said, you know, General, I'm really honored that you did this, you know, that you want me to do this, but I don't know anything about making war documentaries, so I'm going to have to bow out. And Marshall said, oh, really? Because there's guys that have never flown a plane before, and they're going to fly. There's guys that have never driven a tank. There's guys that have never lost a leg before, an arm, and they're going to go into battle. So, I'm sorry, what's your reasoning?
Yeah, right.
Boy, Capra just caved. He said, never mind, you know, and went did it. And I think that is the power. Like, commanders did not challenge Marshall. They knew who they were dealing with and respected him greatly. But that's a perfect example of someone who had no idea what he was walking into with George C. Marshall. And I think that really reflects his personality greatly.
Well, and folks, remember, he's the architect. He's going to put the whole darn thing together, and he did. He did appoint Eisenhower. Oh, but before, John, I want you to comment on Marshall, please.
Sure. Of course, I think on the upside of Marshall, he had this remarkable combination of brusqueness with affability. He had an amazing ability to work, for instance, closely with Ernie King, the chief of naval operations, the number one position in the Navy, who was not an easy character to deal with. And he kept him on the same page throughout much of the war. Same thing with Cap Arnold, who headed up the Army Air Forces, which obviously technically was part of Marshall's command, but still was becoming more independent by the day. So I certainly share my colleague's high assessment of Marshall, but there are two areas I would be a bit contrary in terms of my assessment of his overall grit. Yeah, unlike some of the other generals we've talked about, he didn't necessarily face combat during the war, which I believe, you know, leads to an especially high level of grit, if we're talking about that. But the one area where I think we could say that Marshall failed was that he completely absconded on the issue of race and decided to go along with a segregated armed force throughout much of the war, which led to this really, you know, terrible paradox of the United States fighting this massive war against homicidally racist regimes and doing so with an armed force segregated on the base of race. Marshall kind of went along to get along with that because he had a war to fight and a war to win. So I would sort of downtick him a little bit on those two sides, but I think overall he was certainly the architect of victory. I think that's so well put.
He appointed Eisenhower. Smart move. He pulled this guy out of where? Supply, procurement, Bill? How did...
Actually, Eisenhower is laboring ignominiously as one of MacArthur's unhappy staff officers in the Philippine Islands. And MacArthur finally allows Eisenhower to leave. He's called back to Washington. He serves, I believe, on the War Department staff, and Marshall, who does have an eye for talent, marks Eisenhower and Mark Clark and Omar Bradley and several other talented young officers who are majors and lieutenant colonels, and when the war starts, those guys rise quickly up the ranks in terms of promotion and responsibility. And Marshall trusts these guys with the most critical plans and operations and later puts them in the most critical command billets.
Kevin, 1 to 10.
Oh, Marshall, boy, let's see. I would say he's a 10 with a gold ring around it.
Oh, boy, okay. John?
I'd give him a 7.5.
Bill?
I give him a 10, but John's comment about segregation is noteworthy, and it's worth mentioning that both Gavin and Ridgway oppose segregated forces, Ridgway most notably in Korea.
And how did Eisenhower feel about it? How did Eisenhower feel about all that? Somebody want to jump on that one?
Yeah, I'll sure.
How did Eisenhower feel about
it? Was more along the lines of, let's get the mission first and let's not necessarily rock the boat. Eisenhower certainly believed every American soldier should be treated well and, should be treated with dignity and respect. But he was no crusader in terms of desegregation or whatever else. So if the issue didn't come up, he was glad to not deal with it. If it did, then he would deal with it in whatever way the mission was best. And the evidence of that, of course, is the run-up to Normandy when you have a lot of tension between white and black soldiers in England. Eisenhower has to deal with that, and of course Ridgway too, because a lot of his paratroopers were the ones involved in some of the skirmishes, some of the problems. So Eisenhower is someone who later in life will, take some significant actions to protect civil rights activists by the late 1950s. But during the war, as a general, his primary focus was on winning that war.
And folks, George Marshall, General Marshall, was also architect of the Marshall Plan after World War II, right? Right? Somebody want?
Correct.
Bill?
Yeah. Actually, that was Truman had been working on it, and he had been working on it with Marshall, and Marshall offered to put Truman's name on it, and Truman said, no, God, no, I'm so unpopular, it would never pass. We should say that the Marshall Plan, the idea was to rebuild Europe, to give them the money and the resources to rebuild after World War II. But the only way they could do it is if they worked together instead of as separate nations. They had to work together to rebuild, and that was a sort of an unseen insurance policy against war in the future.
You know, it's interesting. I had all three of these historians list, and Eisenhower was not mentioned by either one of you, which I thought was kind of interesting. In fact, before we finish with Marshall, fidelity, anything, any scoop, nothing? Okay. Religion? Was he religious, Marshall?
What did he say? My father was a Republican, my mother was a Democrat, and I'm a Methodist. That's all I know.
Okay. Sounds like most of the voting public today. But anyway, how about Eisenhower? Let's give Eisenhower on fidelity. Yeah, Kate Summersby, right? Was that her name, Catherine Summersby?
Yes.
His driver? Right. Somebody, okay, well, you know, I can understand. But she wrote a book, right? So.
My boss was Ike or something like that.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, here these guys are great and they're world leaders, but they still have passion and I'm not going to, you know, no more comment anymore on that for Eisenhower, because he did his job. Not only, folks, was he, I want one thing to be commented on, because I've always wanted to ask this question. Was Eisenhower chosen to lead D-Day? Was he chosen to lead, and this will be for John, chosen to lead D-Day, put it all together because he was an organizational person. He knew how to organize, how to get supplies. Is that why? Was that the big reason, John?
Well, certainly that's a factor, but I think more than that, it's his diplomatic ability. Eisenhower had a remarkable ability to forge good, positive, productive, friendly working relationships with a lot of different kinds of people, regardless of where they came from. And Eisenhower had already done that to a great extent in the Mediterranean, so he was a known commodity to the British, to the Canadians, whoever. And also the fact that he was an American. There was no question that an American would head up Operation Overlord, because the Americans, not just really in the invasion, but more importantly in the campaign that will follow, are going to contribute the lion's share of the manpower and material power to bring Germany to its knees. So certainly his organizational ability is a key factor. His planning ability, which he'd already demonstrated in the War Plans Division, which I think Bill had mentioned earlier. But I also think his diplomatic ability as much as anything else.
Okay, we're gonna skip theaters of war.
If I could just echo
jump around
John's comment, and that is that it's hard to imagine another American general who could put up with Field Marshal Montgomery. And Eisenhower has to do that.
I've got to ask.
Someone has to put up with Montgomery, and Eisenhower is the man for the job. It's hard to imagine another senior general in Europe at the time who could do that.
And I understand that the first time they all got together, Eisenhower fires up a butt, and Montgomery, being a very, very non-smoker, was mortified. Tell us about that. Somebody jump in.
Yeah, I talked about that in my book, September Hope, and this was their first meeting, a couple of years before Ike becomes commander of Operation Overlord. Montgomery was giving a briefing to several officers, including newly arrived Americans, including Eisenhower, and Eisenhower lit up a cigarette, and Montgomery stopped his lecture and said, "Who is doing that? Put that out immediately," and made, very sort of rude and obnoxious, as he was wont to be. And Eisenhower's neck turned red. He was so angry. But true to form, he didn't say anything. He was not someone who was going to fly off the handle. So they didn't have an auspicious first meeting.
Let's give it 1 to 10, Kevin. Eisenhower.
Eisenhower, I'd give him an 8+.
An 8.5. Let's give him an 8.5. Okay. Bill?
Oh, I'd give him a 9.
Okay. John?
I would give him an 8.
All right, let's move along to the other theater, Pacific. I want to talk about this guy, Curtis LeMay. I mean, you want to talk. I looked down the list of characteristics. This guy had courage. He had passion. He had bravery. You know, we think, well, yeah, that, they call Patton blood and guts. It was our blood and guts. Well, but the same thing, I think, with LeMay. What he did, folks, the B-29, let's end this war right now. Let's burn them to the ground. Let's take away their will to make war. He took the B-29s, stripped them. That's right. Took away all the armament. They had nothing to protect themselves. And they were coming in low, and they were carpet bombing. The first time you heard carpet bombing, and these B-29s were just blasting the heck out of the Japanese, who God knows how they were able to survive through all that. And he had them. Well, I'm not going to say all this. Bill, why don't you give us a little shot on that?
Well, a couple of things. First, LeMay, similar to Gavin, starts the war as a field great officer and does not make the rank of general until a couple of years on, and he earns that promotion through leadership by example, again, similar to Gavin in many ways. And LeMay is a technical expert. He is an accomplished aviator. He is a famous navigator. He knows aircraft inside and out. But what's really surprising about LeMay is what a tough and inspirational leader he is. He leads by example. His nickname is Old Iron Pants because he insists on flying, leading from the front, leading from the cockpit. And he starts the war leading B-17 raids over France and Germany. And that is an exceedingly dangerous mission with a very low life expectancy. And he and his squadron and then his wing do very well in Europe. And that's why he is selected, because he's one of the best or the best commander in 8th Air Force. And that is why he's selected to go to India and take, I believe it's India, and take command. It might be China. I'm sorry, but to take command of the B-29s, which when they're initially fielded are having trouble delivering payloads over Japan for a variety of reasons. One of which is that while the B-29 is a technically superior aircraft in many ways, it can fly further, it can carry more bombs, it can fly higher. Initially, they had problems with the engines catching on fire during takeoff.
And they were made out of magnesium.
A very bad thing to happen in an aircraft full of bombs.
Yes, they were made out of magnesium, which burns. I was talking to Rebecca Grant on Guam, and there still are pieces of B-29 that didn't make it off. They got to the end of the runway. They were in the ocean. John McManus, tell us very quickly about Curt LeMay.
Curtis LeMay, the word I think of when I think of him is ruthless. Certainly he was brilliant. Certainly he had proven to be extremely courageous flying on some of the deadliest missions in the European theater with the 8th Air Force earlier in the war. By the time he takes over what amounts to basically strategic bombing, the strategic bombing effort in the entire Pacific theater, and most notably, of course, the bombing of Japan, he is determined to bring Japan to its knees by any means necessary. So it's really quite interesting, just a matter of perspective. If LeMay had served on the Axis side, and had come up with his idea of firebombing and entire destruction of cities and whatever else, we might look at him as one of the great villains of the war. Because he was on our side, and because he was so effective in the way it turned out, and what we all recognize as the larger good of the Allied victory, we do see him as certainly a hero, but we also have to recognize what the low-level bombing absolutely meant, which was the deaths of just hundreds of thousands of people in the blink of an eye. And LeMay, in his case, he's not going to bat an eye at that, because he believes that the final outcome is well worth that.
Oh, good, because it leads me to this quote, and gritty people believe, quote, everything will be all right in the end. If it is not all right, it is not the end. And that sounds like Curtis LeMay. And tell somebody jump in on this one. Is it true? I heard and read that if you were one of the raids where LeMay was in charge, leading whatever, and you bailed out, in other words, as you took off, because they were losing B-29s and they had a little problem, they turned around, come back, but that he actually ordered the pilots to keep going and court-martialed those that did turn around and go back to base. Is that true? Somebody jump in.
Well, he did. This is Bill. He did make that threat, and that did have obviously a dramatic impact on the number of crews that turned around. On the other hand, those crews were flying into deadly anti-aircraft fire over the Japanese islands, and so it's understandable, depending on what their abort criteria were, that they might be turning around. But LeMay implemented that draconian solution, and it worked. Crews kept.
I could add something to that. When we think about it from the crew's perspective, before LeMay got there, they were flying generally from high level, about 30,000 feet and up, and they were impervious to a lot of anti-aircraft fire and even many fighter attacks. So the survival rate was fairly high, though the accuracy was not all that good, partially because of winds and whatever else. So now LeMay is telling you, you're going to have to bomb from under 15,000 feet where you're vulnerable to everything and unleash incendiary raids to basically burn out the heart of Japan, thus making the Japanese even angrier. And many of the crewmen believed that this was a death sentence. I wrote about this in a book I did called Deadly Sky, and it really stuck out to me how he almost had a revolt on his hands, because many felt it was tantamount to consigning them to a death sentence. And so he uses, I think, more than just the coercion. He uses, of course, the example of his own personal courage and the tactics he had devised to kind of sell that to his airmen as well. So he's an interesting combination of a draconian actor, but also a military intellectual, too, who does communicate to his crews and is quite effective in the end.
Well, gentlemen, I think we got 3 minutes to go. Can you believe that, folks? Did you all like this? I sure liked it. It's a new format. I'm going to have you all three back on. I've got more names here that you all submitted to me. We got many. We didn't get to George Patton. I wanted to, but then again, I know, Kevin, I know. Well, first of all, Kevin, why don't we got 3 minutes. Tell us what books that you've written. Give us some Christmas stuff.
Patton's Photographs. It's a book on the photographs General Patton took with his own camera during World War II from the shores of Fadala Beach in North Africa and Morocco all the way to Czechoslovakia at the end of the war, and photographs right up to 10 days before his car accident that led to his death. It was a pleasure putting the book together. I found out a lot of new information about the general in the process. I've been told it's a great read. I can't say that. I'm biased. And the second book is Patton, Legendary World War II Commander, which I started with the eminent historian Martin Blumenson, but unfortunately Martin passed halfway through the job, and so I had to finish the book. And for anybody who's looking for an introduction to General Patton, this is a very good book.
Bill Latham, give us your books.
My book is Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea. Over 7,000 Americans were captured during the Korean War, and about 4,100 made it back. We had a high casualty rate. American POWs were terribly mistreated by both the North Koreans and the Chinese during the war, and then in many cases mistreated by the Department of Defense and particularly the United States Army when they got back from the war.
Yes, and how can they find out about your book?
It's available at Texas A&M University Press, and it's also available on Amazon.
And what's the name again?
Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea.
Kevin, how can they get your book, The Photographs, by General Patton, his photograph?
I believe if you go to Veterans Radio's bookshop, you'll find
it. The good man he is. Okay. I'm getting signals here. Real quick, John, your books.
Yeah, my last couple of books, The Dead and Those About to Die, The Big Red One in Omaha Beach. It's all about the 1st Infantry Division at Omaha Beach. It came out last year, and my most recent one is called Hell Before Their Very Eyes, American Soldiers Liberate Concentration Camps in Germany, April 1945. And they can be purchased through the usual outlets that these gentlemen have discussed, plus, of course, Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble and wherever else.
Okay, gentlemen, we're at the end of our program. Here's the band's warming up, and we're getting ready to pull out. I want to ask all three of you, please come back. Oh, by the way, looks like our true grit turned out to be General Gavin. 30 seconds left. Thank you, gentlemen, and I want to invite you to come back again. We're going to do this again shortly. You're listening to Veterans Radio. This is Bob Gould. Dale Thronberry will be back next week. 20 seconds, 10, 9, oh, Lord, you are dismissed.